Welcome to the Aquarimax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 241, recorded 2nd of March, 2015. I had to think there for a second. What is the date?
It is indeed the 2nd of March.
That's what happens when you go on vacation for a week. Then you don't know what day it is when you get back.
Yep. We went to Disneyland.
It was awesome. I think I'm still kind of floating. I'm still on a little bit of a Disney high.
It was a lot of fun. There wasn't much fishy going on there, except for the
fake fish.
The Nemo ride in the submarine. And they did have eastern mosquito fish in some of the bodies of water.
And mermaids.
I don't know if that quite counts as fish.
It's half fish?
I guess it is.
Got a big fishy tail.
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
That's true. Okay, so what do we got?
We have a Google Voice message from Mike in Oregon, and we have an email from Matt in Perth, Western Australia. We have JR in Eastern Kentucky, Mick in Carnforth, UK, Dr. Bob on the North Shore of Boston, Tony in New York, and Carl in I don't know where.
Okay.
Speaking of Mick, I hope everybody enjoyed the interview last week.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
That we aired. It was fun for us to talk to Mick again.
Yeah. So definitely. Okay. Well. Oh, sorry. I'm just trying to do some technical stuff here, but I think we're set up now, so that we can listen to the.
Are we ready Google for? Voice.
But yeah, it was really fun to do that interview with Mick again.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, Mike in Oregon, here we go.
Hey, Aquarimax, this is Mike from Oregon. Hey, first off, I want to say thanks to, I think it was Joe and Scott who contributed to my fish tank filter question about the hang-on bats. Unfortunately, before I heard that episode, I had a major crisis. My canister filter pump completely died. I couldn't revive it anyway, and so I was in crisis mode at that point, so I just went ahead, kind of went off the pet fish talk guy's advice, bought two Penguin 350Bs and got them set up and running, and thought that I might have been in a crisis, because after reading a few aquarium message boards, you know, people seem to be of the opinion that if your pumps go down, that you could have a bacteria issue as far as the die-off of the beneficial bacteria. So I watched my tank with my test strips, and thankfully I did not have any change in ammonia levels, nitrate, nitrite. Everything stayed constant, so having the filter die on me didn't proved to be a disaster, which I was very grateful for. Didn't want to lose any of my fish. So anyway, that's how that all played out. The whisper or the penguins are up and running, and everything seems to be going great. So anyway, thanks again for all your guys' help, and I'll talk to you later. Bye.
All right. Well, I'm glad that everything worked out well for Mike.
Good that nothing crashed.
Yeah. Sometimes if you can get a filter set up right after the other one crashes, you still have enough bacteria living on the other surfaces in the gravel and different things like that, that you can avoid issues. So that's good. Sounds like that's what happened. And we'll hope that it'll continue to be effective.
Okay. Should we go to Australia?
Yes. Western Australia, in fact.
That is actually someplace that I would like to go someday. That's
me too.
On our bucket list, I think Australia would be neat to go play in. Okay, so Matt in Perth, and he says, G'day, Aquarimax. My microphone has developed a strange clicking noise, so it is back to the emails for now. I have decided to... Okay, and I don't remember how to pronounce this brand of CO2 system. It's S-I-C-C-E.
And if it's Italian, it's
Cicce. But it's probably not Italian, so it could be Sissy or Sicky or Sicy. I don't know. But so he decided to buy the Sicce CO2 system, despite the negative reviews. I feel it is worth a $90 risk for something that could have a positive impact on plant growth with almost zero maintenance. I bought 9 new plants, and I have to say my tank is looking stunning. So, Matt, you should send us some pictures. Says, I love watching my discus gliding angelically through the Vallis and Sword plants. And yes, I have noticed the 2 older discus are more aggressive, but not to a point where I worry about the health of the 4 smaller discus. On the whole, it is a peaceful tank. Thank you for appreciating my contributions. I really appreciate your podcast. I wish there were more like it. I talked to a different assistant at my local fish store, and they confirmed that I do not need a protein skimmer or a filter as long as I do frequent water changes in my future 2-foot marine tank. And we talked about that last time, yeah? Okay. I am thinking 30% once a week. That comes to just over 16 liters or 4 US gallons. 2 buckets to do a water change. Small tanks do have some big advantages. I still do not have a start date for the marine aquarium, but I will keep you informed of the progress.
Cool.
So, on to today's questions. If you have to pick one book that is the best all-round guide to keeping freshwater aquarium, what book would that be? Also, the same question for marine aquariums. For me, it's the... How would you say that?
Looks Bench?
German. Bench?
I don't know.
B-A-E-N-S-C-H.
I think I've heard it pronounced Bench, but...
Aquarium Atlas. It covers all I need to know about fish species and aquatic chemistry. One last question. My local fish store has an all-in-one setup for marine tanks called Red Sea. Despite the increase in costs, I love the idea of a group of engineers sitting down and designing a complete aquarium-in-a-box system that contains everything you need to succeed in keeping marine or freshwater fish. What do you think of all-in-one packages?
Okay, well, it's...
So, book and packages.
Well, in terms of books, I guess I've read a lot of fish books over the years, but... Honestly, there's not one for freshwater or saltwater that just kind of jumps out at me. One just jumps out at me and says, this is my go-to, really. So, I mean, there's lots of good things and lots of good books. So, I'd like to kind of throw that out there and have Aquariumaxers say what you think. What is your go-to book for marine aquariums? What is your go-to book for freshwater aquariums? I think, you know, and to a large extent, people refer to specific websites for specific things they're looking for. Like, they'll go to fishbase.org for, you know, information on where the fish is found or its maximum size or different things like that. So there's some of that going on now, more so than before. But just what are the books that you specifically refer to? I'm going to throw that out there for Aquariumaxers. And in terms of the all-in-one packages... I think it really depends on the company that's putting it out and the degree of quality of the product, too. I mean, there's the low-end stuff out there that's really basic and is not, you know, it's okay for a general-purpose starter kit, but it's not great for more advanced things. And then you have some of the others that are... they've got really high-quality components, particularly with the marine aquaria that you can get. The all-in-one packages have with really high, good-quality lighting. Or some of the marine ones that I like have different options. Like you can get the, I believe it's the Nano Cube. You can get it with a lighting that's sufficient to grow, say, soft corals. And for viewing your fish... Or you can get one that is for growing, you know, the small polyp stony corals with really super high light. And it's essentially the same kit except for that, the different lighting, things like that. So I think it depends more upon the company and basically whether or not you're paying for a premium product or not. Okay. But I think a lot of the marine products... that I've looked at least, it seems like the high quality ones that if you're willing to put some money into it, they really do, they have thought it through very well, and it's nice because everything fits together well aesthetically. You know, they've got stands that match the aquariums, and they've got protein skimmers. They know it's going to fit where you need it to fit, and you know, the lighting all fits under the hood perfectly, and you don't have to modify anything. So I think there are some advantages to those if you go with the all-in-one packages, and to some extent, because like what I was saying before, you can get different models, to some extent, they can be customizable. You can set, I want this package because I'm only growing soft corals, or I want this one because I'm going to grow bubble tip anemones or, you know, giant clams or something. So that's my general idea. Did that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. All right, so let's move on.
Okay, so thank you, Matt. And we will go to JR in Eastern Kentucky. He says, my plan a week ago Saturday was to continue running the citric acid and baking soda system with the added valve to shut off the CO2 when the lights were out and go 2 weeks between refills. All was going well until midweek when I noticed an unusual amount of citric acid pumping into the baking soda side. Since the system works by equalizing pressure, my thought was there must be a leak somewhere, possibly on the baking soda side. After checking all the connections, I discovered that the baking soda bottle was the problem. The unit comes with what appears to be silicone washers that go between the bottles and the unit. When I installed them, my thought was they were a bit flimsy, but I used them anyway. When I removed the baking soda bottle, I found the washer had ripped, probably when I changed powders on Saturday. A trip to Ace Hardware for some O-rings put us back in business. Around the day of the O-ring fix, the solenoid valve I had ordered on eBay came, so I installed that. Okay. What's a solenoid valve?
It's basically a way to regulate the flow of the gases, or the, it can be liquid or gas, I guess, but it's regulating the flow. Let's, we can go with that for now.
Okay.
Yep.
I had the timer set to turn the valve off at 7 p.m. and went to check it to make sure the flow had stopped. Unfortunately, there were still bubbles going through the bubble counter, but at a much slower rate. I had remembered reading somewhere that some solenoid valves need the flow going a specific direction. Mine has no markings to indicate flow, so I thought it would not matter. I reversed the flow anyway, and sure enough, that fixed the problem. It still remains to be seen if I can go 2 weeks on a mix at 2 BPS. Bubbles per second.
Yep, okay. Good.
For some reason, bubbles per second just in my head seemed like something that should be like on My Little Ponies. Like they have a big bubble generator and they're talking about bubbles per second. Okay, sorry. Sometimes I just have a weird brain. But you guys already know that. Okay. I'm hopeful, though, because on this mix where approximately a third of the citric acid was siphoned prematurely, I was still able to go 8 days and maybe 9 if it lasts through today. And then he says on, this is later, he's writing on the 23rd, I will refill the bottles and see how close I can get to my goal of 2 weeks at 2 BPS during the lighting period. I will let you know. I also want to look closely at operating costs as compared to a pressure system. Obviously, the initial setup cost is cheaper for the citric acid baking soda system, but how will it compare long term once the equipment is bought and paid for? I am shopping around to see how low I can get the cost of the powders to go by buying in bulk. JR in Eastern Kentucky.
That's a good point. Even the initial outlay or the initial cost might be less, or it is less. It is important to think about how it might be over time. You know, I've heard people say that about do-it-yourself yeast reactors too, that, you know, the initial cost is very, very low. But over time, you buy sugar, and even though sugar is not that expensive, over the time of buying it, it can add up. It might cost a lot more to buy sugar for 6 months than it is to buy one, you know, CO2 cartridge, or, mm-hmm. you know, CO2 tank, I mean. So
how much is the citric acid? Baking soda is pretty cheap, is it? Just normal, straight baking soda like you would buy for the kitchen?
Yep, it's just kitchen-grade baking soda, that's all it is.
So how much is citric acid?
Citric acid is more expensive. You can buy it in canning supply areas, and you can also buy it online, and in larger quantities it tends to be cheaper, like he's saying.
Okay.
It's cheaper to buy in bulk. But it's a lot more expensive than baking soda.
Okay.
So it's good to think of all those things. But it's been interesting because, mm-hmm. You know, I've been wanting to do this, and I know a lot of other aquariumaxers are looking at different options for CO2, so it's good to learn more about this. I appreciate JR's explanations of what's going on with that, and we'll look forward to hearing more about it.
It's time for that station break thingy when I tell you how you can play an active part in the Aquarimax community. If you want your questions or comments featured on the show, send us an email at info@aquarimax.com or call and leave a message at 801-477-0629. You can also subscribe to the Aquarimax YouTube channel, like our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter.
And now for a blatant but extremely brief plug.
Our ebook, The Aquarimax Guide to 7 Easy Live Foods, is available on Amazon.com for $2.99.
Okay. And Mick in Carnforth, just kind of a quick note here. He has this really cute picture of a hedgehog with his daughter.
It's really cute.
They both look really cute in the picture, and we're going to have to put that
just
up.
Just a little wee baby hedgehog. Yeah.
And he's got some other pictures that he put up. Some Beatles pictures, which I know are not fishy, but we're going to put them up anyway because they're fun. Beatles made out of jelly beans.
What?
The four. The Fab Four. The Beatles. You know, Rocky Raccoon. Oh, yellow submarine.
Meant, like, bugs, like, from
no,
his ugly
didn't
bugs.
I show you that? Oh, no,
you didn't show me
I showed
that
everybody
one.
Else when we were on vacation.
You showed me the super uber cute hedgehog
I did.
Picture.
I forgot to show you the Beatles one, but I showed everybody else. And they thought it was really cool, and they guessed that it was jelly beans.
Okay, the I get to see the jelly bean jelly picture beans. Now.
It's really cool.
Who made it a picture is. Out of jelly beans?
It's, I don't remember.
And did they eat it when they were done?
Well, I don't know about that. See, they went to Liverpool. Well, at least that says Liverpool right there. Yeah, they did. They stopped off at Liverpool. That's what it was. They went into the Beatles shop and a sweet shop nearby. Had made the Beatles out of jelly beans. See the mosaic there?
Oh, my goodness.
That's really cool. We're going to put these pictures up.
That's pretty incredible.
I love that. Yeah.
Well, you guys will have to go see the cute hedgehog and the edible beetles.
Yeah.
Beetles with an A.
And all the other pictures. There's mm-hmm. a couple others, too.
Okay. So, we've got Dr. Bob on the North Shore of Boston. Mm-hmm. He says, Dear Russ and Kelly, I've been listening faithfully but unable to contribute over the past few months. Thank you for your consistently helpful podcast. I often feel inspired and always feel entertained. That's good. I'm glad you're entertained because I have a great deal of fun making a mostly big idiot out of myself
that's
for
not,
your benefit.
That's not what you do.
Okay. He says...
You can be silly without being... It's not being an idiot. It's just being silly. There's a difference.
Okay. He says, I have heard you talk about your Opaiula shrimp and began thinking about looking at starting a freshwater shrimp tank before trying another brackish water tank. I began with a 2-gallon bowl and used the Wallstad method planted with Java fern and crystal wort. I used aged tank water and allowed the nitrogen cycle to start and allowed the tank to run for 8 weeks. Then I introduced 1 red cherry shrimp, a rogue individual that I received in a batch of whisker shrimp that I used to feed my native sunfish. I also put in a tiger nerite since I had quite a batch of algae growing by that time. All went well, and the lone shrimp is still thriving in the unheated, unfiltered, unfed planted bowl at temperatures between 64 and 68, depending on the heat in the house.
Cool.
Yeah. So in the fall, I started a 10-gallon freshwater tank with a large sponge filter and a 50-watt heater. I used black sand as the substrate and some Java moss and Zuzvassertang. He put in a pronunciation guide for me, which is very kind. Thank you. I'm still not sure I got it right. He says it's German. Zuzvassertang. Tang, tang? How would
I'm
they say
it? I'm not sure if it's tang or tang.
Okay. And literally means sweet water seaweed. I used aged water from one of my other tanks to get the nitrogen cycle started and allowed the tank to run for 8 weeks.
So that is very much like Pelia. It's a liverwort like Pelia.
And it means sweet water as in fresh water.
Right.
It's like freshwater seaweed.
Right. That's what it.
Okay.
That's what the German name means, yes. It's not really seaweed.
That's just what they're calling it.
Right, but it's
but
really
when they say
a liverwort.
Sweet water, they mean like fresh water.
Yes.
Yeah. I purchased a batch of 25 red cherry shrimp from a local breeder through Aquavid and drip acclimated the shrimp over a 4-hour period. Once the shrimp were introduced to the tank, they immediately went to work moving the grains of sand to find food. I fed the shrimp every other day, a very small quantity of finely crushed flake food and spirulina powder. Within 2 weeks, all but one died. Oh. It was about Thanksgiving, and I had little time to do anything about considering next steps, so I left the tank alone. The one shrimp seemed to be okay. I thought about putting the two shrimp together, but never got around to it. Well, about a month ago, I got a batch of 10 red cherries and put them into the 10-gallon tank. There was one fatality within about 48 hours, but the rest seemed to be doing well. Yesterday, I even noticed there were several micro-miniature baby shrimp in the tank, like newly hatched. At this point, I'm going to chalk this experience up as either a bad batch or a batch that just failed to survive the environment I provided. Have you any other thoughts? Finally, what is your recommendation on feeding? Do you think the flake and spirulina is a good food mix? If this tank thrives, maybe I will try a tank with Opayula this summer after we get back from our Big Island vacation. He can just get them over there.
Can you get them over there?
And are you allowed to just
bring them? It's not impossible. It can be done depending on the situation.
If he buys them there, he'd probably just get it checked out at the inspection station, yeah?
It depends. It depends on where you get them.
I don't know.
You have to get them from certain facilities to be able to do that with licensed hand carry, you know,
stuff.
It's possible. It is possible. It's just not always possible with all the vendors and whatnot.
Okay. So. Well, that's something to look into, though. I mean, if you're going to be there,
it's
paying the shipping.
Yeah, it might be a possibility.
You're already paying the airfare.
Right.
Says, hey, maybe your next book should be on the proper care and feeding of Hawaiian shrimp. That would be cool. Thanks again for all your wonderful podcasts. I look forward to more inspiration and entertainment. Best wishes, Dr. Bob.
Cool. Well, hopefully we can provide lots of both. Mm-hmm. Let's see. So back to questions. Okay, so this tank set up, cycled, and planted previous to the cycle, it sounds like. So you allowed the tank to run for 8 weeks. Were you introducing any sources of ammonia at that time? I'm wondering if what happened is, if there wasn't quite enough plant biomass in that 10-gallon tank. There may have been, so I'm just
trying to think of ideas.
Yeah, and I don't really have an idea of how much plant biomass there was. So one scenario running in my head is that there is a 10-gallon tank. You put in, you know, the water, you put in the substrate, the plants, they all sound great, but if the plant mass wasn't that great, then it wasn't enough, then maybe when you put the shrimp in, it's possible you could still get an ammonia spike after a couple of weeks of those shrimp being in there. And the plants weren't enough to take care of it, and if ammonia wasn't being added during the 8 weeks of the cycling, then maybe the cycle didn't really, you know, occur enough. Mm-hmm. Maybe there was some minor bacterial growth, but not enough to actually handle the amount of ammonia that the shrimp were putting in. If the plant biomass, on the other hand, was high enough that they were taking care of all the ammonia as soon as it was being produced, then you don't really need to cycle the tank in the sense of, you know, bacterial cycle, because the ammonium is going to be converted into, you know, plant mass, and you don't need to worry about it. So I'm not sure which of those scenarios. If the first scenario I mentioned, when the plant biomass wasn't that high, then it could indeed have been an ammonia issue. If, on the other hand, the plant biomass was quite high, then that probably wasn't it, and I'm not sure what it was. But those are my thoughts on that. Recommendation on feeding flake and spirulina being a good food mix. I think that sounds like a good basic diet, and of course they're going to be collecting things, biofilm and algae in the tank as well. And a lot of people like to use, you know, safe leaves, like, it depends on the type of leaves. Sometimes they'll put some Indian almond leaves in there and allow them to slowly break down and the shrimp will eat them, or oak leaves or different things like that. Of course, it's important to make sure they haven't been exposed to pesticides and they've fallen and begun to kind of fall apart on their own. Kind of like what I use for terrestrial isopod food, the same sorts of leaves. They will eat that. So that's another option. It's not really necessary, but a lot of people do use that as something there. But I think the flake and spirulina is a good staple
good
diet
mix.
For them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there we go.
So it's nice to hear from you again.
Yeah, it's been a while, but mm-hmm. we're glad to you're back with us.
Okay, Tony in New York. He says, hello from beautiful Arctic New York. Yes, it's been very cold back there, I hear.
Indeed.
Thanks for the show last week. Really enjoyed it and learned a lot about the Opayula setup. Thanks so much. I had a question about disinfecting aquarium items, such as siphon hoses, fishnets, things like that. What's the best way? On a side note, I was wondering if soaking them in plain old tap water would work. After all, it is full of chlorine and chloramines that are there for the purpose of killing off the bad stuff. What do you think?
Okay. Well, what do I think? Maybe I'll answer the last part first.
Okay.
About tap water is certainly going to kill off some of the bugs, the nasty things, for the same reason that Tony cited. But there will be a lot of things that it won't really touch. One of the nastiest being Mycobacterium.
Which we hate.
We hate Mycobacterium when they're in the pathogenic state. And there are... they're very resistant to chlorine and chloramines. So these bacteria have been isolated in swimming pools, for example, doing quite well. Thank you very much.
That's a little scary.
Yeah, it is. Swimming pools that are full of chlorine, not just, you know, swimming pool that's been outside and neglected for a few weeks and nobody's right. added any chlorine. We're talking about municipal swimming pool full of chlorine, the kind that when you walk into the
building... You practically building, asphyxiate because there's so much chlorine in
it
there.
It stings your eyes, and they're finding Mycobacterium in pools like that.
Wow.
So it doesn't do much against those. And in fact, chlorine, the use of bleach to disinfect aquaria and aquarium items can sometimes lead to Mycobacterium gaining a foothold, because one of the best things to keep Mycobacterium under control, is the probiotic idea, where you're keeping other faster growing bacteria out competing the Mycobacterium. But once they're out of the way, because they're not resistant to bleach, then the Mycobacterium has this empty area where it can proliferate.
Over.
Exactly. So that's kind of something to think about. I guess while tap water can kill off a lot of things, it's not going to kill off some of the nastiest bugs, I guess, is the short answer. And what is the best way? You know what I usually do when I need to sterilize something? I put it in boiling water.
What about siphon hoses?
And siphon hoses, you can't really do that.
Because they'll melt.
Because they'll melt. Or at least they'll get really soft.
Can you microwave them, or would that just melt them too?
I think it does kind of the same thing. I haven't really tried the microwaving thing.
Dishwasher with, like, not dishwashing soap, just the hot water? I don't know if they're dishwasher safe.
I've never tried that, and I don't know that they're dishwasher safe either. Generally, I haven't come up with a good way to sterilize a...
siphon hoses.
Like a big siphon hose, like
a python.
I just haven't. With really small ones.
Well, that one's
ones,
so big, how would, you know?
Yeah. I have run bleach through them to get algae out, mm-hmm. but it doesn't really, and it does help with that, to get algae out, but it, because there's that sort of gunky algae that will grow inside the hose,
because right.
it stays
damp.
And I don't know if it's really algae or if it's a fungus or whatever it is, but it will grow in there and stay in there. It may just be bacteria, I don't know, but whatever it is, I will use bleach occasionally to get that out. But it doesn't help against, you know, like I said, the Mycobacterium. With small hoses, I've used, like, high percentage alcohol solution, like 70% alcohol, isopropyl alcohol solutions. Mm-hmm. I will run that through it and then let it dry. So that kills a lot of things.
Off stuff.
And Mycobacterium really don't have much of a defense against alcohol. Alcohol is really
That's
effective
good.
Against Mycobacterium, so use that. But, like, if I just want to do a net or something, I'll get a wide mouth jar and throw it in the microwave to boil some water in it, and then I'll stick the net in there.
And just let it soak there?
And let it soak there.
For how long?
For, you know, 5 minutes.
Okay.
And that's what I use when I really need to sterilize something.
Okay.
In terms of sanitizing, I think, you know, rinsing something in tap water takes off a lot of the gunk, and so you're going to reduce whatever you're introducing into your tank through that, especially if it's hot tap water. I think that's... it's more helpful, but it's not going to be sterilizing. And I think you're going to get closer to sterilization, of course, with the boiling water. And that's what I usually go to if I feel like I really need to sterilize something. But I know that there are disinfectants out there that other people use. That's really what I stick with, pretty much those two things. The 70% isopropyl alcohol which sometimes I'll put in a spray bottle and spray on a net, mm-hmm. or something like that, or run through a hose, like I said, and then the boiling water. Those are my two go-tos.
Sounds good. Okay. So, he continues, Matt, I wanted to comment on your upcoming clown tank. First off, wonderful. I once had a clown tank and mine was also 10 gallons. I guess you and I and Russ and Kelly are all in the 10-gallon clownfish club. Sweet. Do we get a little membership card?
Maybe if Tony sends us one.
That would be cool. We could come up with a secret handshake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And little, we could be the card-carrying members.
Yeah. Okay. So, my two cents. First off, two small clowns in a 10 definitely works. I believe I had a heater, a hang-on-the-back filter, and some crushed coral substrate. I did not have live rock, but did frequent water changes. Worked like a charm.
Good to know.
Yep. Regarding your idea of a skimmer and no filter, this is what comes to mind. Russ, please correct me if you disagree, please, but mainly if you can keep the following out of the water, you will be golden. Ammonia, nitrites, nitrates, and organics. Your live rock, if it is mature, should handle the first three, and the skimmer will help with the organics. At this point, the only thing a filter would add would be the ability to take particulate matter out of the tank. I'm not sure that this will be an issue, so your plan may, quote-unquote, hold water. And then he said, it in parentheses, some New York humor for you.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good to mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, my large 120-gallon tank has no filter and just a skimmer, also lots of live rock. The former owner tells me it has done great without a filter for a long time, had said something about running one once in a while. I wish I could tell you more. I am relatively new to saltwater fish keeping.
Hmm. I wonder if it was running like a diatomaceous earth filter or something.
Do those only run once in a while? Or?
They're generally useful as water polishers, but they sort of... It's kind of an older thing. I don't know that people do it a whole lot anymore.
Hmm.
But the idea is just to, you know, strain really small particles out of the water. And so they call it a water polisher.
Interesting.
And it wasn't intended for continuous use.
Oh, okay. It's like exfoliation for your tank.
Kind of like
you don't
that.
Do it every day.
Right. I wonder if that's what he's talking about.
Maybe so. He says, I did listen yesterday to the Reef Threads podcast number 116, which had some more details. Gary and Christine, who host the show, kind of give me this weird feeling that I am listening to the alternative universe versions of Russ and Kelly. Hey, we should check it out.
Yeah.
Maybe they're like our...
alter egos?
Alternate twins or something. Still, it is a great show, and I am starting to understand that saltwater can be an entirely different hobby in a lot of ways. That's true. I got a funny feeling when Gary announced that smaller tanks are definitely easier to maintain than large ones on one episode, and then went over the reasons why. Whoa, Twilight Zone, everybody. It is the flip side.
In a lot of ways, yeah. That's a very good point.
It's like the dark side of fish keeping.
Or the very bright side, considering the metal halide lights and the LEDs and the...
Yeah, but for as bright as the lights are, you can't see PFAS. A dang thing.
I'm not sure what you mean by that one.
Every time I look at a saltwater tank, it feels dim. And everybody's like, oh, these lights, they're so bright. They grow this stuff. And I'm like, but I can't see anything. It just looks like blue and dim, and I don't like it.
Ah, maybe you're talking about the actinics, right?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, but that's what, every time I see a saltwater tank, they're like that. And I'm like, I'm squinting at the fish.
So you've never...
This is not comfortable.
Well, they have... often really bright lighting above saltwater tanks. But sometimes when you have like a coral propagation tank, something like that, when the mm-hmm. purpose is just to grow out little coral frags or whatever, that you don't have... The purpose of the light is not so much illumination for the human eye as it is just growth of the corals. Then they will focus on some of the light that's not very bright to us, but mm-hmm. it's photosynthetically available to the organisms. And so, like, Fish For You has a couple things like that.
Yeah.
And is that what you're talking about?
Well, those are worse.
Because, I mean,
but
there
it just seems like the majority of saltwater tanks that I look into, it's stressful for me to look into, even if the fish are really pretty, because I feel like the lighting is making me strain.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Next time I see one that makes me do that, I'll tell you.
Yeah, point that out. I'd be interesting to see. Because if you put like a metal halide light above a marine tank, it is really bright. Not just you know, photosynthetically available, but it's bright. So
next time I see one that makes me squint and strain, I will tell you.
Okay.
Okay. He says, anyways, right, check out episode 116. I believe the research shows that a protein skimmer may only take out 26% of the organics or so. In other words, water changes are still beneficial. Also, on 116, they further discuss the roles of skimmers versus water changes. It wasn't exactly your question, but I thought you'd find it to be of interest. Additionally, I'd like to add that there is an interesting discussion on clownfish in episode 120. So all my best.
Oh, go ahead.
And yes, in my new 120-gallon, I also have two clownfish, just for old time's sake. Says, looking forward to our next one, everyone, and also Mick's upcoming interview. JR, loving your commentary and detailed accounts on recent shows, too.
So it does sound like he's got some very relevant podcasts.
So that might be
marked there.
For Matt.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Wrong thing came out of my mouth.
No, thank you for sharing that. That sounds interesting, and I wonder if
you should check out that
podcast.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That would be funny. And if we ever meet them, like, one of us will be wearing white and the other one will be wearing black. And I have brown hair, so maybe Christine has blonde hair. If we're, like, the flip side.
Okay. And so, like,
I don't know what the opposite of red hair would be.
I don't know.
More red hair. Red doesn't have it. It's not like a light dark thing. It's red. Okay. Oh, we have another one from Matt?
Yep, we do.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But we totally do. That's okay.
Okay.
The part of the problem, folks, I just have to apologize that, you know, we've been gone for a while on vacation, and I've been doing my best to collect all the podcast submissions. But part of the deal is that the app, the notes app that I usually use, has crashed and died and
shuffled things off this mortal coil.
And so if I missed something from somebody this week, I apologize, and please just send it again. Because a whole bunch of stuff got fried. But I tried to reconstruct it from my email, so hopefully it worked out. Anyway, let's go ahead.
So this is again from Matt, and it looks like he has some comments on Mick's interview.
Cool.
He says, I disagree with Mick in the recent podcast about tank busters. It is true that many will grow to larger than their tank size. However, I have had experience that directly contradicts that all mentioned species will outgrow their tanks. I had a Placo in my 4-foot discus tank, and it never got longer than 10 centimeters or 4 inches. I had a... What kind of Placo was it?
That's a very interesting question. It's a good question to ask.
Because the bristlenoses get 4 to 6 inches.
Right.
Doesn't matter what size tank you put them in, that's just what they get to.
Right.
But that's different than the gigantic Plecos.
It is. Mm-hmm.
He says, I had a Placo in 180 centimeter by 60 centimeter by 60 centimeter, or 6 foot by 2 foot by 2 foot, and it did not get longer than 15 centimeters, which is 6 inches. I've also kept Oscars that never got longer than 10 centimeters in the 4 foot previously. My clown loaches and silver sharks are both supposed to be able to reach 1 foot in length, and yet they have barely grown since they went from the 4 foot to the 6 foot tank. So in my anecdotal experience, the theoretical maximum length of a fish is not genetically determined. Bear in mind, I'm only contradicting the species I've had direct experience with. I have no doubt that red-tailed catfish can get up to a meter in length. It would be interesting to see if there are any scientific studies into the matter.
Hmm. Well, thank you for bringing this up, Matt. I think it's a good thing to, you know, when you hear a general rule to look at exceptions and see why they're exceptions and so on. That's very good.
Probably thing to the do. Reason it's the rules because you don't know if they're going to get that big or not. And if they have the potential to get that big, you should be prepared for them to potentially get that big.
Right. And I think, he is agreeing with Mick in the sense that in general this kind of thing does happen, and he mentions that a couple of times that he does agree with
just
that.
Just doesn't necessarily, but he's saying that happen every time.
He's had cases where it doesn't always work, and the question you brought up is very important, and that is, what kind of Placo was it? Because there are so many different kinds of Placos, including bristlenose Placos that don't get big.
Right.
So,
which is why we like them.
Exactly. That's why I prefer to keep bristlenose Placos. So I would be interested in finding out what type of Placo you're talking about there, because there are so many species. There are so many species of Placos that they just have numbers for them. L numbers.
Wow.
For a lot of them, because they haven't been scientifically described yet. And so it could be, you know, any number of species that don't get big. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few that don't. And I think in the podcast, we're specifically thinking about the Trinidad Pleiko.
Those ones that get huge.
Or common Pleiko, yeah, the ones that get gigantic. So now if these were Trinidad Pleikos, then it would be interesting to try to discover why they didn't grow mm-hmm. to their maximum size. But I would be interested to see what type they were. And then the Oscars, you know, he's talking about, they say it's got a 4-foot tank. And he had Oscars that never got bigger than 10 centimeters, which is
4 inches.
4 inches. And that's interesting. And, you know, like in the Thai restaurant that we like to go to, mm-hmm. they've got that Oscar is like over a foot long, and it's in a pretty small tank.
And they had them in a bigger tank previously, but then they downsized.
And they did, that's true. They but still, the tank was probably no longer than 4 feet.
The original tank?
Yeah, I don't think it was. I don't remember exactly, but... it was bigger than the one they've got it in now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you get all these different cases. So, you know, Matt had these Oscars that didn't get bigger than 4 inches. Mm-hmm. Even though we know that Oscars are capable of doing it, but these specific ones didn't. So that's an interesting case. Also, with the clown loaches and the silver sharks, my understanding of with clown loaches is that they can get to be a foot long, but it can take years and years and years for that to happen.
That's like really old ones.
Yeah, and I have seen pretty big clown loaches. What's that place? They have some at the aquarium in Sandy, not too far away from here, that are pretty big. But I think that some of the biggest ones I've ever seen were at McLeod's.
Oh, near my parents' house.
Yeah, in California. There's a pet store there that they, and I don't know if they have them anymore, but they had a really big tank with some big placos, but they were old. They had been there for a very long time. Mm-hmm. So, in that case, it may just be a matter of age. You know, they weren't old enough to get that big yet. But, yeah, it's always good to look at these cases and see what we can find out from the cases where it doesn't happen. And I have had, you know, occasionally a goldfish that stays a lot smaller than I would expect.
Well, and that makes sense, too, because... individuals are all individuals, not
right.
Every single member of a species displays the exact same characteristics as every other member of the species.
Right, but if you buy 9 goldfish mm-hmm. and put them in a tank, you know, 9 of them at least are going to grow really big. And more than 9, you know, if you're looking at it statistically, mm-hmm. more than 90% of goldfish are going to get a lot bigger than they would be comfortable in a 10-gallon tank, or especially a 2 or 3-gallon tank. But there will be an occasional one that will not. And whether that is a function of environment or genetics or diet or all three or, you know, those things, that something that remains to be seen. But I think it's good to think of it from the standpoint that generally, yes, goldfish, Oscars, and these other fish are going to tend to outgrow the tanks, but it's good also that what Matt points out is that not universally, there are sometimes mm-hmm. exceptions, and understanding the exceptions is kind of key. What is behind those exceptions, and hopefully we can find out more about that. I seem to remember reading a study about channel catfish, where they put some channel catfish in a tank. And I believe it was a flow-through system, so that essentially constant water changes. Mm-hmm. And they fed the fish plenty and so on. The fish grew to the capacity all the way across the tank.
Oh.
From one side to the other.
They let them out.
Hopefully they did. But I can't recall a whole lot of specifics about the study or the citations for the study. So anyway, it's probably a good thing to look up. And if any of you aquariumaxers out there have some data that you would like to... contribute to that. That would be interesting.
Okay, so thanks for the discussion, Matt. And do we have something else from JR in Eastern Kentucky?
Oh, yes. We kind of had another aquariumaxer wrote in and wanted some more information about JR's system, and so I was able to get them in contact with each other.
Okay.
And this was Carl was the name of the other Aquarimaxer. I'm not sure where Carl's from, so I'll just say Carl in question mark. But,
okay. We could say Carl in Neverland, because, you know, that's more fun, and we just went to Disneyland. So, can you be Carl in Neverland for this week?
And then next week you can tell us where you're from, if you like.
Yeah.
But, so JR in Eastern Kentucky was mentioning that he had posted a thread about his experience with the citric acid and baking soda system on the plantedtank.net. And he has included a link here. So we will put this link up on the show page. So those of you who want to follow his experience there on the forum as well as on the podcast, you can do that.
Okay.
And Carl has sent a picture of his setup. He's doing the citric acid and baking soda too. And he says here, he sends a picture along and has some text here for us.
He says, here's a picture of setup. Solenoid is plugged into the same timer as...
Finex? LED light?
Oh, is that a brand?
Yeah, it is a brand.
Sorry, guys. It had the little spelled wrong line under it, and so I didn't know if you typed it, you know. Phones type funny things. Okay, anyways. Into the same timer as a Finex LED light. It wouldn't work until I got rid of the leaking original needle valve and placed valve past
Past the solenoid.
Now there's no issues. Sorry, sometimes people send in texts and they're not very grammatical. And it's hard for me to read what they're trying to say.
It's kind of shorthand because it was captioning pictures. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so we'll include the pictures up there too so you can see what's going on with that. And it's always good to have more information on how this is working. So now we've got at least two Aquarimaxers who are testing out this system and can give us some insights into how that's working. So I think that is about it for this week.
It's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, if we miss something, we apologize. And please just send it again and we will address it.
Till then, we will see you next week.
May the fish
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. To leave comments or questions that could be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.